Michael, good morning.
G'day, Annie.
So, first of all, for our listeners who don't know, could you just give us a quick summary of successful offensives that took place at Mosul?
Okay, so the offensive really began in October last year, and they took the eastern side of the city by about February. And then in March, they started in on the western side of the city. It's a much more difficult prospect than the east. It's a very old city. There were some streets that were so narrow you couldn't get armoured vehicles in. In fact, soldiers had to go in sort of singly or in pairs. And so ISIS found that much easier to defend. As a result, the old city, some of which is, you know, 900 or 1,000 years old, has virtually been flattened by airstrikes, by mortar strikes, by gunfire, and by bombs, IEDs. And it's, you know, it's an incredibly sad place to be, actually. You know, you're standing in these sort of medieval streets looking at this absolute destruction. And I guess the worst part of it for some has been the destruction of the old mosque. It was 900 years old. It had a famous leaning minaret. And ISIS blew that up shortly before they were ousted from the area. So there's, you know, probably thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people buried under the rubble. There's, you know, whole families, whole communities displaced, up to 1 million people in refugee camps within the country, and really a city that needs to virtually be rebuilt from the ground up.
Now, just in terms, you just said that the you know, the city is virtually flattened. So, you know, what's left at Mosul? Is there any part of the physical city that's really left?
Look, there are houses here and there. We met one old bloke who's in a wheelchair, actually, and has no family, so couldn't get out. He was right near the centre of the city. He was still living in his house. The soldiers were kind of keeping an eye on him, and he was there with his broom and just sweeping his porch. It's kind of hard to describe exactly how much rubble and rubbish there was in the streets after this campaign, but he was still house proud enough to be wanting to clean up. So, you know, yes, there's still life in the city, but really he's in the minority. As we went through the streets in the past couple of weeks, there were just hundreds and hundreds of people, families, children carrying their, you know, a little boy carrying his even smaller brother, both barefoot. You know, families escaping and leaving the city and going out to live in camps. These people have been without real food for a long time, for some of them up to 6 months. They were absolutely malnourished. I've talked to doctors and medical people who've seen grass in the stomachs of people who were injured or cardboard soaked in water. So, you know, it really is an incredibly dire situation there.
Now, how do we go about rebuilding such a broken city? I mean, it's absolutely tragic, there's no doubt about it, but there definitely needs to be rebuilding. So how does that happen?
Look, I'd say two things about that. One is, you know, obviously it's an incredible task, and it's really unclear at the moment how the Iraqi government might be going about that. As I understand it, they will replace the infrastructure, the water and the power, and the clear the streets and that kind of thing. But the actual buildings themselves, the houses particularly, and the businesses are the responsibility of the owners. So there are going to be many people who can't afford to rebuild, and the economy in Mosul is trashed, as you can imagine. So that's going to be one thing to think about. The other thing, though, is slightly more optimistic, and I went on this trip also back to East Mosul, where I'd been in January, just after the liberation. And it was, I mean, I thought it was trashed when I'd seen it first time round. It's actually a lot better looking now than it used to be, and I've been really surprised at the speed at which people have been able to rebuild and that life has really returned to the streets. So, you know, they're an incredibly resilient people, the Iraqis. They've been through a massive amount in our lifetimes, and I think, you know, they will bounce back from this despite the trauma and the damage. Clearly it's going to take quite some time.
And just on a different point, Mosul's quite diverse. So how do you think this Iraqi state will actually go about, you know, ruling and governing it?
Well, that's right. Mosul is one of the more diverse cities in Iraq. It's been one of the more cosmopolitan. There's right near the great big mosque that I've just referred to, there was an enormous church, which has also been bombed. About probably half an hour's drive from Mosul is a city that was almost entirely inhabited by Christians. There are the Yazidis, who have their own sort of pantheistic religion, who live nearby in Sinjar. So I think the challenge here is for the Iraqi state to essentially win back the trust of the people. And it's not just ISIS that's destroyed that. The trust of the people in the Iraqi state was very low even before ISIS came along, and for very good reason, because they've been treated appallingly by the regime in Baghdad. So, you know, the challenges in Iraq are probably even bigger than the physical rebuilding, is the essentially rebuilding the idea of a functional Iraqi state. Without that, we'll see a lot more of the kind of movement that ISIS represented, the radical jihadism and other kinds of extreme movements.
Now, what do you think that President Haider al-Abadi's most difficult task as president will be in the months to come?
Look, I really think it is that the idea of trust and security. And without security, you can't have trust. And without trust, you can't have security. So one challenge, for example, is that in order to fight the battle against ISIS, he's created or allowed to flourish, I suppose, a very large number of armed, organised militia groups who come from come from religious motivation. So there's the Shiite militias and the Sunni tribal militias and so on. And he's kind of authorised those groups in the battle against ISIS to carry arms and to have their own organisation. And he said that they can be part of Iraq's armed forces. I think anyone can see, given Iraq's past, the kind of trouble that could prompt and lead to. And so those militias will need to be very carefully kept under control and watched. And it's not clear that the army, for example, or the police are strong enough and have enough credibility with the population to be able to keep them under control. So I can foresee, you know, enormous trouble coming again if tribal warlords essentially begin to assert their power.
Yeah, so you've talked quite a bit just then about security, so, and then kind of the difficulty with the fact that he's got these militia groups and the army isn't so weak, but how important is it to maintain the constant and strong security presence in Mosul?
Well, I think, you know, it's clear from my conversations with local people there that really, after all this, they are tired, they are exhausted by the amount of fighting. Nobody who is an ordinary resident has any appetite for fighting anymore, but they may not be able to control that. And so what they crave is security. And what that has kind of prompted in them is a little bit of nostalgia for the time of Saddam, who, despite having killed perhaps a quarter of a million people, Kurds and Shiites and you know, chemical weapons attacks, launching a campaign in Iran, becoming an international pariah, people are now, and these are ordinary middle-class Iraqi people, are kind of reminiscing about that period of history, because at least they, the Sunni Arabs, the majority, felt that they were secure. And that's really, it's a sad indictment on what's happened since Saddam was overthrown in 2003.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today just to have a bit of a chat about this. We really appreciate you making the time.
It's a great pleasure, Annie. Thank you.